Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Environmental Law and Property Rights and Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Groups, was recorded on Tuesday, June 24, 2014, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on the public land controversy, the states versus the federal government. My name is Christian Corrigan, and I am Director of Publications at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and also that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today we welcome four experts. The first is the Honorable Ken Ivory, who is a state representative at the Utah House of Representatives. The second is Professor Donald Koshin from Chapman University School of Law. The third is Carl Graham, director of the Center for Self-Government in the West at the Sutherland Institute. And our final expert is David Garbett, who is staff counsel at the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance. So today we're going to hear a presentation from each of our four experts, and then we'll finish off with questions from our audience to end the call. So without any further ado, I'll turn it over to Representative Ivory. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Christian. Appreciate the Federalist Society holding this teleform. Appreciate all the other panelists that have taken time to be on this and those that have come to discover a little bit more about this fascinating question. You know, I think it all really starts with that map. Many of you have seen the map where you've got more than 50% of all land in the western United States is controlled by the federal government, and yet less than 5% of the land in states east of Colorado is controlled by the federal government. And that just begs the obvious question, why the difference? And that's certainly been a question that we've grappled with in Utah for a number of years, particularly given that 67% of our land is controlled by the federal government. And so you have a legislature and a governor who that govern about 33% of our state. It raises a number of questions on a daily basis, but particularly where this really started to come about was we realized that as we started looking at the economics, and in 2011 we started to see signs of things crumbling at the federal level, and that nearly 40% of our revenue, single largest line item of revenue to Utah, is federally sourced funds that in the federal financial statement it tells us it's unsustainable and going away. Pretty big problem. We also know that we're $2.5 billion below average in per pupil funding. And as we look at that, there's no way that we tax our way out of those tremendous holes. And the resources that we have locked up that we know are substantial are really the only solution big enough. And that led us to begin studying the issue and trying to look at it anew. And as we started doing that in 2011, we discovered a unanimous U.S. Supreme Court opinion, Hawaii versus the Office of Hawaiian Affairs, that stands for the proposition that Congress does not have the authority to unilaterally change the terms of statehood, the Enabling Act, the Solemn Compact of Statehood, the Supreme Court has called it. Well, that sent us on an adventure to look at the questions, why the difference, and why did the federal government ever hold these lands in the first place? Well, what we found was going back into the 1830s, 40s, and 50s, states like Indiana, Illinois, Missouri, Arkansas, Louisiana, Alabama, and of course, you know, that great western state of Florida, they were as much as 90% federally controlled for decades. And they were sending resolutions and delegations and petitions to Congress. In fact, they're available at the website AmericanLandsCouncil.org. You can go on and see historical documents and see their petitions and resolutions. But Florida was saying things like, we can't educate our children. You're controlling all our land. We can't grow our economy. You're not keeping your promise to dispose of these lands. And these states got together. They rallied around one Democratic senator from Missouri, Thomas Hart Benton, who rallied them. And as they refused to take no for an answer, they compelled Congress to transfer their lands and honor their promises of statehood. And what we found out, which is contrary to common wisdom, their statehood enabling acts, their contract of statehood, what the Supreme Court has called solemn compacts, bilateral agreements with rights and obligations on both sides, the language in their enabling acts are in many cases, most cases, material cases, exactly the same as the language in the enabling acts of the western states. They say things like, forever disclaim all right and title to the unappropriated public lands to the federal government, and yet the rest of that sentence in Utah's enabling act says, until title thereto shall have been extinguished. Also says in the enabling act that 5% of the proceeds of the sale of public lands, which shall be sold, shall be paid to the state to support the common schools. Well, imagine that. We've got a $2.5 billion gap in per pupil funding in Utah, and our Enabling Act says that the federal government shall extinguish title to the lands, and 5% of the proceeds, if they sell the land in extinguishing title, 5% of those proceeds are supposed to be paid mandatorily under the agreement to the state to support the schools. Looked like an opportunity. We began to investigate even deeper. We found that North Dakota, for example, has word for word the same operative language on disposing of the public land that Utah has. In fact, Montana and Washington have the very same document, Enabling Act document, as North and South Dakota with respect to disposing of the public land, and yet Montana still has 27 million acres controlled by the federal government. Washington has something like 45% of its state is still controlled by the federal government, and yet North Dakota went from more than 50% federally controlled land at statehood to now somewhere around 3%. And of course, we know they have a $6 billion rainy day fund. They're putting billions into classrooms, billions more into schools and roads. We also knew environmentally that the status quo just simply is not working. Wildfires, catastrophic wildfires, are off the charts. I mean, the record-setting years we're having in wildfires have all occurred within the last decade or so, killing millions of animals, destroying watershed for generations, air quality impacts, and destroying habitat. And so with these tremendous issues, we knew that the only solution big enough was to engage in compelling Congress to simply honor the same statehood promise to Utah that it's kept with all states east of Colorado. Well, in looking at that, and as we started going down this road, it was really fascinating when we would ask the simple question, why the difference? Why is it that the federal government controls more than 50% of the land in the western United States, against 67% of Utah, 81% of Nevada? Well, we started hearing things like, well, your land is arid, therefore the federal government keeps your land. And it was almost hard to believe that these opinions were coming out of law professors and political science professors and others saying, well, your land is arid, so somehow, therefore, the federal government has authority to keep the land. But if you think about that argument on its face, Oregon, Washington, Alaska, 50%, 45%, 62% federally controlled, respectively, arid, I mean, that argument doesn't hold water on its face. And yet that's the argument thrown out very frequently as to why the federal government controls these lands. The other argument is you just simply gave up your land. The founders of your state just didn't want them, and so they gave them up, and they throw out six words in an Enabling Act without looking at the whole document. So in the Transfer of Public Lands Act, I mean, those arguments obviously don't hold water, and so we started moving forward beyond that and finding just this rich history from 1763 all the way to our statehood, where courts and congresses and presidents have all affirmed that the federal government merely held the lands in trust. So that led us to passing the Transfer Public Lands Act, where we set a deadline, a target date of December 31st, 2014, for the federal government to work with the state in transferring federal public lands as state public lands. And that's critical. Federal public lands become state public lands for the multiple use, sustained yield with local planning, carrying over all of the existing rights for hunting and fishing and grazing and mining and access, and to have multiple use, sustained yield with local planning. And so we started with that bill. We've since passed a number of other bills. In fact, we passed the first ever State Wilderness Act, the Utah Wilderness Act, this year. We passed an Interstate Compact Act to start working with other states on an interstate compact for the transfer of public lands. And the sum and substance of everything is simply compelling Congress to honor the very same statehood promises that it kept with all states east of Colorado to fund education, better care for the environment, and grow the economy locally and nationally. I think, Christian, at that point, I think Professor Cochin is up next.
Yeah. Sorry, this is Christian. Professor Cochin, we'll turn it over to you now.
Thank you very much. I want to thank the Federalist Society for organizing this teleforum and the other panelists for providing their perspectives on these important issues. We have only a short window to help outline some of the issues. My goal is to focus on two. One, what is the legal argument for the TPLA from a compact-based duty to dispose? And secondly, why is it so important that we understand the meaning of dicta in this debate so that the legal arguments do not become oversimplified? For those looking for a longer explication of my thoughts on the Utah Transfer of Public Lands Act, I've authored both a January 2013 Federal Society white paper and a more recent article in the BYU Law Review dated 2013, although it was only just printed this past spring. Both of these are available to download on SSRN or the Federal Society website, and I encourage you to look at those. Governor Herbert once noted that the legal case for HB 148 or the Transfer of Public Lands Act may not be a slam dunk, and I agree with that. But there are legitimate arguments to support the law, and certainly critics of the law have been overstating their legal case against it. At the very least, there are open legal arguments involved in the TPLA that have never received definitive resolution in the courts. I'll begin with a contract-based theory, the compact-based duty to dispose. The argument goes as follows. The TPLA simply enforces a promise made when Utah became a state that the federal government has heretofore seemed unwilling to completely honor and fulfill. One can argue that the state of Utah has relied on that promise and that the TPLA is simply calling in a debt created by the same. Utah's Enabling Act, as Representative Ivory has already explained, the UEA, established its statehood and was approved in 1894. The question becomes whether, one, inherent in the original compact, the federal government accepted a duty to dispose of the public lands it acquired in the UEA, and separately, two, whether the state of Utah can enforce such a duty by demanding that the federal government live up to its obligation to dispose of such property into other hands. Agreements matter, and the parties to them should faithfully and diligently adhere to their promises. This is true whether such agreements are between private parties in the government, or two governments. Longstanding precedents support the theory that the UEA is a bilateral compact that should be treated like it is and interpreted as a binding contractual agreement. The critical provisions in the UEA have already been explained somewhat by Representative Ivory. These are Sections 3 and Section 9. The only appropriate way to read these provisions is in conjunction with each other and the whole agreement in the UEA. The U.S. Supreme Court has explained that it is, quote, a cardinal principle of contract construction that a document should be read to give effect to all its provisions and to render them consistent with each other. Moreover, the court has also recognized, quote, the intention of the parties is to be ascertained by an examination of all they have said in their agreement and not of a part only. So, beginning our analysis of the UEA by looking at Section 3, as Representative Ivory has already indicated, that states, quote, that the people inhabiting said proposed state do agree and declare that they forever disclaim all right and title to the unappropriated public lands lying within the boundaries thereof, and that until the title thereto shall have been extinguished by the United States, the same shall be and remain subject to the disposition of the United States. Section 3's forever disclaim language leads some to believe that Utah's case for upholding the TPLA is a dead letter. However, it must be read in context. First, even within this section, the language shows that the parties anticipate that title will at some point be extinguished. The, quote, until the title thereto shall have been extinguished language, together with the words disposition, in other words, disposal. When opponents focus only on the forever disclaim segment of the UEA and say that this one phrase settles the case against the TPLA, they're looking at a part only or a single sentence, approaches expressly rejected on the rules of construction recognized in the courts. The interpretation of any written instrument must be informed by surrounding words in all sections. Moreover, this language is perfectly consistent with the ends to be achieved. The federal government needed clean title to land so that it could dispose of the properties to willing buyers. There was a fear that potential buyers would be unwilling to purchase lands from either the federal government or the state government if the buyers could not be sure which one had superior title. The UEA resolved that and sent a signal to would-be buyers in the market that the uncertainty of title had been resolved. The state, in return, also gave a promise that added further certainty to the buyers. The state agreed it did not have the power to interfere with the process of disposal or with rights granted through disposal. Excuse me. Thus, the state had a selfish interest in wanting the federal government to have certain title because it increased the state's own gains under the agreement because it was entitled under Section 9 of the UEA to a percentage of the proceeds from disposals. Representative Ivory has already given us a glimpse into that. The state wanted the disposals to work well. This means that the state is invested in and relying upon the existence of disposal, which in consideration for this percentage of the proceeds in Section 9, the state agreed to help facilitate by disclaiming rights in Section 3 to the unappropriated lands so as to give the seller in the disposal market, here the federal government, the valuable commodity of certain title attached to the property disposed of. Basic rules of construction require harmonization of Section 3 and Section 9. If the federal government could retain the property, the state would never get any benefit from Section 9. It is hard to believe that the state intended to agree to disclaim rights in return for a cut of the sales of those lands, and in anticipation, therefore, that actual sales would occur so that there was a cut to be had, yet intended no corresponding obligation that the federal government actually dispose of such lands. Now, the second point. The major legal arguments against the TPLA rest on broad interpretations of the property clause in the U.S. Constitution, Article 4, Section 3. Opponents of the TPLA invoke broad statements about federal power when the states overstep in relation to the compacts, and they call these statements in the cases precedents for the present case against the TPLA. Advocates favoring the TPLA are at a public relations disadvantage. They hold almost no directly responsive case cards, real controlling precedent, or even dicta pretending to be precedent, as there are almost no cases about the state's powers when the federal government oversteps its obligations or fails to fulfill its promises in these compacts. The cases just do not exist. That creates a disadvantage. The advocates of laws like the TPLA, therefore, must employ the power and skill of distinguishing cases and educate the courts and the public about when some seemingly precedential judicial statements are distinguishable or actually dicta. A large part of my article in the BYU Law Review outlines this exercise of distinguishing the cases. That process, unfortunately, cannot be reduced to a soundbite and cannot be fully explained in my 8 minutes here. But it needs to be done. The substantive part of the TPLA defense needs to find a way into the discussion. The existing cases do not resolve this case for either side. If read correctly, they certainly do not foreclose the interpretation of a compact-based duty to dispose that I have just discussed. The Property Clause does indeed confer broad powers to Congress, but it's not without limitations. Much of what is being cited as precedent against the TPLA is not precedent at all. At times, courts say things in case opinions, and it is more than necessary to resolve that case. They can be verbose, and sometimes they overstate background principles. Sometimes in the process, they use excess language that's susceptible to interpretations beyond what the judges would have meant to say had they been able to fully predict the misuse of their words. A brief lesson in distinguishing dicta is how I'll close. I'll offer just a few final thoughts. One of the classic statements regarding the definition of dicta and its non-controlling nature comes from Chief Justice John Marshall in the seminal case of Cohens v. Virginia. There the court stated, quote, "It is a maxim not to be disregarded that general expressions in every opinion are to be taken in connection with the case in which those expressions are used. If they go beyond the case, they may be respected, but ought not control the judgment in a subsequent suit when the very point is presented for decision." Black's Law also defines dicta as a judicial comment made while delivering a judicial opinion, but one that is unnecessary to the decision in the case and therefore not precedential. This concept of extra or unnecessary language is ever present in most of the cases discussed by those who oppose the TPLA. And I will leave it to our question and answer period to discuss any of those specific cases, or again, I refer you to my other work. These tools of interpretation must be employed against all of the cases that will be cited against the TPLA to get a full legal picture of what truly is the state of the law. And I contend that for the most part, it is an open state of law, and there remains a credible case to be made for this compact-based duty to dispose. And with that, I will turn it to our next panelist.
Okay. All right. So next we'll hear from Carl Grimm.
All right. Thanks. So I'll shift gears a little bit here. I've been wandering around the Rocky Mountain region here is where I'm concentrating most of my work on. And I've been talking and visiting and speaking with and to political activists and industry leaders around the region, getting perspectives, gauging concerns, and in many cases encouraging support of legislators, of county commissioners who have turned out to be an important audience, and also think tanks and various interest groups. And what I've found is there are a set of basic concerns that continuously come up, and I don't offer necessarily the solutions in 8 minutes, but I want to outline what some of those concerns are. And they fall into three basic categories. The first one is a dissatisfaction with the status quo as far as federal lands management goes, and this goes across many different types of users, whether they're state and local government users, whether they're agriculture, leaseholders, mineral leaseholders, or recreational, primarily hunters and off-roaders and those kinds of folks, because they're seeing, there are several things they're seeing, but one of the most important is a decreased access to federal lands for most of these users. In Utah, we see the state is suing the BLM over lost access or in a very slow leasing process on a lot of land. In Montana, close to 2 million acres of federal lands are basically unavailable for public uses of any kinds. We see this through inholdings. We see this through creating of pseudo-wilderness areas, wilderness study areas, things like that. Road closures. And the resource management plans that disallow most uses. In Otero County, we see through the Endangered Species Act, but through other areas as well, whether it's water or listings or potential listings of things like sage grouse, jumping mouse, prairie chickens. Again, just a decrease axe to public lands that boils over into private lands sometimes as well. So that's the first category of concerns I see, is just a dissatisfaction with the status quo as far as access. The second one falls from that, and it's an increasing, and I think it's increasing very rapidly, dissatisfaction with federal land managers, what's seeing as an arrogance and an indifference to the concerns of local users. There's this feeling that when someone comes to a meeting, a federal land manager comes to a meeting, whether it's Forest Service or BLM or whomever, they have an attitude of, we know what's best for you, and we'll let you know when we decide what it is. You can come in later, and you can make comments if you're a county commission or a city commission or something like that, but you're not allowed a seat at the table when those decisions are made. And that's very frustrating, and the frustration I saw, I was in New Mexico last week, was very, very tangible at being left out of that process and considered lesser users, lesser decision makers, even though somebody at the state level, at the university, range biologist or somebody like that has every bit of the expertise that somebody in D.C. has, and yet they're not allowed to participate in that process. They're only allowed to comment on it and come begging for changes if they feel changes should be made. This is kind of a regulatory capture in reverse, is what they're seeing. Regulatory capture, of course, is when an industry captures the regulator. In this case, they feel like the regulator has been captured by interests that don't have those other multiple use users' best interest at heart. And so they feel like they've got an opponent in the management process for federal lands rather than a partner. And that's becoming very destructive to the relationship overall, and it's going to make things harder to resolve as we go down the road, unless that that attitude changes from one of an opponent to one of a manager in land conservation and use decisions. The third area of general concern I see is what we're talking about today, is the potential for our concerns related to a potential transfer of public lands or changes in policy like that. The first one that always comes up is the cost. Can the states afford to manage public lands that are transferred from the federal government to the state, whether it's for fighting wildfires, maintaining roads, maintaining recreational facilities, whatever it is? And that's a question that is in the process of being answered, but certainly needs to be addressed head-on and in detail. Second one is legality. We just heard about that. That's a question that always comes up. And so I refer folks to the BYU Law Review article and say the basic conclusion is it isn't a slam dunk, but it's definitely worth trying or worth looking at. And the third area under the TIPLA-like policy is existing rights and traditional uses. And Representative Ivory hit on that, but there are a lot of users out there who have rights, actual rights, whether it's mineral rights or grazing rights or whatever. And then there are also traditional uses, and I would consider these implied rights, even though lawyers often have their heads exploded at a phrase like that. I think people get it, that if you hunted with land on your grandfather, public lands, you also want to be able to hunt on that land with your grandson. And so those traditional uses have to be respected. And there has to be a process, an open and participatory process, for ensuring that those traditional rights and traditional uses are respected as part of a transfer. So the bottom line, I think, here is, as I go around and I talk to these groups and I listen to these groups and individuals as well, is I think we really are reaching a boiling point, as we do about every generation or so, it seems, with public lands. But I think this one is hotter and potentially more destructive than previous boiling points that we've seen. The stakes are definitely higher as we see some of the uses become less compatible or more strident. The users become more strident in their voices. I think that the enmity is running deeper between the traditional federal managers and the traditional users of those lands. And the stakes, I think, are, well, I already said the stakes are greater. And so the combination of those two things makes for a potentially hot debate. It is a hot debate, and we're seeing it bubble up from the ground up rather than from the top down, which I think is also very interesting. And we're going to hear more about it as we go. Something, I think, over the course of the next few years is going to fundamentally change in how we manage these lands, how we use these lands, and how we decide who gets a say in how those lands are managed. And I hope that calls like this, which I applaud the Federalist Society on, can have a positive input into how we go about making those changes and how we figure out the best way forward for these lands are. Thank you.
All right. Well, after the first three, we're now going to turn it over to David Garbett, who's going to speak for about 15 minutes. And then following that, we'll go to questions. So, Mr. Garbett, floor is yours now.
All right. Thank you, Christian. Like the other panelists, I would like to thank the Federalist Society for organizing and hosting this call, and I want to thank the other panelists as well for joining me today. The Transfer of Public Lands Act, or as I will call it here, House Bill 148, violates the United States Constitution, the Utah Constitution, and Utah's Enabling Act. It's bad public policy. Now, at its heart, this is not really an argument about legal principles or equity. The real motivator here is a control of resources and the venue for political decision-making. These decisions are better left to the political arena since these are the resources of the American people as a whole, rather than the courts. I just can't help but remark that it is a bit ironic that we have an environmental attorney participating on a Federalist Society event to remind House Bill 148 proponents that judicial activism of the sort contemplated here would lead to bad outcomes and bad law. And I feel like in a rush to espouse this idea, they've jettisoned faith in limited courts and the sanctity of contracts. And I think, as Mr. Graham pointed out, they have also failed to account for the significant costs that transfer would entail for the states. And that, you know, this is a reason why Republican governors in both Idaho and Arizona have called this a bad idea and have opposed similar efforts in their states. So let me talk about two ideas here. One, the legal arguments for House Bill 148, and then quickly I'd like to touch on the public policy arguments for House Bill 148. Now, in terms of legal arguments, again, as I said, Utah's legal claims fail here because they violate the U.S. Constitution, Utah's Constitution, and the Enabling Act. Now, Professor Koshin correctly points out that the U.S. Supreme Court has never tackled head-on the question of whether or not Utah's Enabling Act requires the federal government to dispose of public lands within its boundaries. But I think that the court's decisions on other issues and dicta do help us understand where it's likely to come out. And for that reason, just this month, one assistant Utah attorney general explained to the legislature that, or committee to the legislature, that such a case would be a long shot. Now let's talk about why this violates the U.S. Constitution. Under the United States Constitution, specifically under Article 4, Section 3, Congress is given power over territory and property belonging to the United States. The Supreme Court has said that that power is essentially unchecked, and that the I just lost my place here in my notes. Let me jump to this. Sometimes I've heard Representative Ivory, in talking about the property clause, explain that it does not give Congress control over public lands. In fact, it only allows it to dispose of public lands. But that's sort of a reading improperly crimps and interprets the property clause. The Louisiana Purchase, for example, set the precedent a long time ago that federal land acquisition was proper, and that Congress was in the driver's seat. Now, in terms of the Utah Constitution, as we've heard here, some of the language from the Enabling Act, this Enabling Act language was adopted straight into the Constitution. This is the language that says that the people inhabiting this state do affirm and declare that they forever disclaim all right and title to the unappropriated public lands lying within the boundaries hereof. And as Professor Koshin and Representative Ivory pointed out, this also continues to say that until the title thereto shall have been extinguished by the United States, the same shall be and remain subject to the disposition of the United States. So even if you were to read this language about the United States' administrative control of these lands as an indication that they should be sold, my response would be, so what? They have not been sold, and so the state of Utah, in its constitution, still has a commitment that it will lay no claim or title to those lands. So under our own constitution, what we are doing with House Bill 148 is unconstitutional. Now, Utah's Enabling Act, where all of this confusion comes from, is this an area where Congress made a promise that would allow us to overcome these constitutional hurdles? What I would say is ultimately, while there may have been some prevailing attitudes about land disposal, public land disposal, around the time of Utah's statehood grant, these were not specific promises made to Utah. Rather, what does this Enabling Act contract say? House Bill 148 supporters rely on this potential ambiguity of whether or not there should be land sales to argue that we need to overturn an arrangement that has been in place now for over a century. But I think that history shows us the best way to interpret the Enabling Act, which is that Congress, as the Enabling Act clearly says, has authority to dispose and retain, to control, to administer public lands, and that until they decide that they no longer want to do that, the state of Utah has no claim on public lands. Now, history shows why that is the case. So when Utah became part of the United States in 1896, this territory had been acquired as a result of the Mexican-American War. So this was a federal territory, an area belonging to the federal government before Utah became a state. Now, if Representative Ivory is correct in his interpretation that Utah was expecting, once it became a state, that these lands would quickly be sold or disposed of, he has some explaining to do, because in 1897, so 1 year after Utah became a state, the federal government created Utah's first forest reserve. Now, this is important because a forest reserve was an explicit statement by the federal government that it was not intending to dispose of public lands, that it was intending to retain those and manage those lands. Now, before Utah was even 20 years old, it had added all of its national forest units, covering millions of acres in the state, as well as Natural Bridges National Monument, Dinosaur National Monument, and the precursor national monument to Zion National Park. Likewise, in 1902, an LDS church priesthood session had members vote on whether or not the federal government should withdraw from market protection of public lands. And the members attending that priesthood session voted that they should. Now, I'm not saying that the LDS church or the Mormons set policy for the state of Utah, but what I am saying is that if an interest group in this state that constituted a supermajority was urging the federal government to take action to retain, to manage, and to withdraw from disposal federal lands within Utah's borders, then I think it's hard for us to say today that there was always an expectation that land would be turned over from the get-go. History shows that was not the case. Now, I think one might interpret some of Representative Ivory's opening statements here to indicate that the federal government has actually handed over large chunks of land in other states. And yet I have not seen where that is the case. Rather, the federal government disposed of lands through various public laws, such as the Homestead Act. These laws were equally applicable in Utah. Now, why did Utah retain so much federal land in the beginning? Well, in part because it is arid. Representative Ivory has said he doesn't understand why that makes a difference. Well, arid land is more difficult to homestead. Arid land is more difficult to ranch. So you did not see as much land privatized as a result of that. That reason we have so much public land. And it's no coincidence that Nevada, Utah, Wyoming, Arizona, New Mexico, Montana, and Colorado, our most arid states, are also our states with some of the highest percentages of federal public land. So now, even if we ignore the constitutional hurdles that I've talked about and we ignore this history I've talked about and we read the Enabling Act as saying that the federal government does need to dispose of public lands within the state of Utah, I still think that Utah has nothing to enforce in the courts. And the reason for that is that, one, there is no date certain. There's absolutely no date that you can find in the Enabling Act where Congress would say when these lands should have been disposed of. And then second is that land sales are actually taking place. The United States has sold and it continues to sell federal land within Utah's boundaries. And so how could a federal court come in and say that they have breached their contract? Now, these land sales may not be taking place at the pace or in the numbers that HB 148 supporters would like to see, but they are taking place. Now, quickly, I want to jump over to policy arguments and say that public lands are a public good. They benefit the public, but they would not be replicated by the private market. People prize public lands for their freedom, solitude, and beauty. Now, if Utah were to take over public lands in the state, it is not likely to retain as many lands as available to the public as we currently have now. And I think one example of this was in the paper recently when the state announced that it would be auctioning off part of a state wildlife refuge, principally because the local county felt that the percentage of public lands in that county was too high. We've heard that locals know best. Well, I'm not necessarily disputing that, but saying that most day-to-day decisions made on federal public lands are actually made at a level close to the lands at issue. For example, the Bureau of Land Management, the agency responsible for managing roughly 40% of the landmass in the state of Utah, has field offices that are located throughout the state. So these field managers are many times closer to the lands at issue than Salt Lake City. Also, public lands do not prevent school funding. If that were the case, we could look at the U.S. and see that states with high levels of private land would be better funded than those with low levels of private land. And that is not the case. School funding across the United States does not track with the amount of private land available, particularly if you look at this on a per capita basis, which I think is the best way to do, which compares apples to apples. States with large amounts of public land, for example, Alaska, are able to fund their schools quite well. States with virtually no public lands and very little private land, such as Massachusetts, New Jersey, are also able to fund their schools very well. Utah, which has quite a bit of public land, but also a fair amount of private land, particularly on a per capita basis, comes out at the bottom, and I think that is for other reasons separate for public lands. So again, I think this leads us back to the fact that public lands give all Americans a say in how land should be managed, and that's where the rub comes. Mr. Graham talked about local county commissioners who are frustrated with land management. And I think that's reflective of policy disagreements with how public lands management takes place. And again, those sorts of disagreements should be resolved in the public policy sphere, in public debates, rather than seeking recourse from courts. So in conclusion, I would just say again that House Bill 148 violates the U.S. Constitution, the Utah Constitution, Utah's Enabling Act, and its bad policy. Instead, Utah should embrace its heritage of remarkable public lands and the benefits they bring to residents of the state, country, and even the world. So with that, I will turn it back over to Christian.
All right. Now we'll go ahead and get the question and answer portion going. We'll open the floor to your questions, our callers. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. And after that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key. And so, again, that's star and then the pound key. While we're waiting for questions, do any of our first three panelists want to respond to anything that was said at the end?
I'd sure like to take a couple minutes on that, Christian.
Okay. Representative Ivory?
Yes.
Okay, great. Go ahead.
Yes, it is. Mr. Garbett repeatedly stated that compelling Congress to honor the same promise it kept with all states east of Colorado would somehow violate the U.S. Constitution, Utah Constitution, and the Utah Enabling Act. I find that really interesting because the Constitution, Article 4, Section 3, says Congress shall have the power to dispose of and make new needful rules and regulations respecting the territory, and nothing in the Constitution shall prejudice any claims of the United States or of the particular states. Well, that's pretty unusual language. And so when you go back and say, what did they intend? What did they mean by that? Well, there's constitutional debate on that section. And they said they were dealing with the Western Territory. And what had happened was in 1780, during the middle of the Revolutionary War, the United States were out of money. And they're in the middle of the war. Seven states have claim to the Western land, six don't. And the United States begged and pleaded and said, if you will cede your claims to Western lands to the United States, we promise, solemn promise, trust, that we will only hold these in trust for the states ultimately to be created and use the proceeds to pay the debt. Well, you have courts and congresses and presidents throughout the history. In fact, down as late as 1894, the very year of Utah's Enabling Act, Supreme Court said the federal government only holds territorial lands in trust for the several states ultimately to be created. Supreme Court also said when Illinois, Missouri, Arkansas, Louisiana, by the way, Louisiana also has that same forever disclaim language in their Enabling Act from the Louisiana Purchase, and yet they compelled the federal government to dispose of their land. Supreme Court case at issue with Alabama in that said that once the United States has fully executed the trust, the states will be the sovereignty of the states will be complete. They'll be on an equal footing. That the United States never held any sovereignty, jurisdiction, or right of soil in the territory for the new states, except for temporary purposes to execute the trust. And so when they rely on this forever disclaim language and say, well, therefore, this is somehow unconstitutional, it really simply doesn't follow. The Enabling Act language is the same. North and South Dakota, Nebraska, Oklahoma, Louisiana, Alabama, and they actively worked and compelled the federal government to dispose of their land where they were controlling it for more than for several decades. Mr. Garbett quoted a priesthood session of the LDS Church as authority. I find that really interesting. But the Utah legislature, less than 20 years from statehood, the Utah legislature passed a resolution demanding disposal of the lands. And they said, in harmony with the spirit and letter of the land grants to the national government, which is what happened back in 1780 and forward, and in perpetuation of a policy that's done more to promote the general welfare than any other policy, and then get this, and in conformity with the terms of our Enabling Act, we demand the President and the Congress for the speedy return to the former liberal national attitude toward disposing of the land. And by the 1930s, the states had banded together. Congress held hearings for the purpose of granting remaining unreserved public lands to the states. However, the federal agency stepped in and said, we'll grant you title. We know we have to grant you title to the land. We're going to keep all the minerals. And the states banded together and killed that bill that would only keep half the promise. In fact, our Democratic governor at the time, Governor Dern, said, you would leave us with nothing but the skin of a squeezed lemon. And 18 months later, they passed the Taylor Grazing Act as a stopgap toward disposal. And the very first line of the Taylor Grazing Act, which is what created the BLM, get this, the very first line of the Taylor Grazing Act says, in order to promote the highest use of the public lands pending its final disposal. And so from 1780 all the way to 1976, Congress knew it was obligated to dispose of the lands. It was in 1976 that Congress said, now we're in the Federal Land Policy Management Act, now we're simply going to retain these lands in federal ownership, but don't worry, we're going to give you payment in lieu of the taxes you would have received if we had kept our original promise and duty to dispose of the lands. And that's working out terribly now because the federal government is broke, and so states are receiving no revenue. Josephine County, they're down from 30 sheriff's deputies down to 2 because all of these transfer payments where they're paying states to not use their own lands are going away. And so people are literally getting brutalized in counties because they simply don't have these promised federal transfer payments to offset the revenue they would have got if they'd kept their original promise to transfer the lands. And so, you know, that idea that somehow this is unconstitutional is really a stretch where the Constitution itself says Congress shall have the power to dispose of, not keep the land forever. And that was the duty. You look back to the history, you look at the cases, you look at what happened when Illinois and Missouri and Arkansas and Louisiana and Florida were making the same arguments. They have that exact same language in their Enabling Act that Mr. Garbett points to somehow say this is unconstitutional. Promises are the same. It's already been done before. And given the devastation to the environment from centralized failed federal policies, it's the only solution big enough to fund education, better care for the land, and grow the economy.
Professor Garbett, would you like to take a
minute
to respond to that before we go to questions?
Yeah, just quickly again, this is David Garbett. This goes back to what I explained before. Article Article 4, Section 3 of the Constitution says that Congress shall have the power to dispose of and make all needful rules and regulations respecting the territory or other property belonging to the United States. It doesn't say Congress shall only dispose of. Reading only the word dispose results in such a crimped interpretation of the Constitution. This is why I was saying that, you know, if we followed that logic, the U.S. could never acquire land. We never could have made the Louisiana Purchase. How could Utah have ever even joined the United States since this was originally Mexican territory? I think that we're stretching the Constitution beyond what the Supreme Court has recognized. And then, you know, I think what I had explained before about the Constitution, the Enabling Act, stands on its own. And to respond to Representative Ivory, even if he were correct in his arguments that there is a commitment to dispose of lands, and we need to be careful here. He, I think, likes to conflate the idea of gifts to states and disposal. We still have never heard of any actual large gifts to states. Oklahoma, North Dakota, they were not granted large blocks of land. Instead, there were disposal laws on the books. These lands were privatized by individuals. They were not given to states. Those same laws were on the books in Utah. Individuals did not take advantage of those laws or could not because of our geographical realities. So it wasn't a matter of states going in and saying, hand over what you promised. The federal government had pursued particular policies. Those policies simply did not work in Utah. This is not about what was promised in the Enabling Act. Now, even if Representative Ivory were correct in thinking that there's some sort of promise in the Enabling Act to dispose of federal public land, like I've said, it would be unenforceable. The federal government is doing that. They are disposing of federal public land. Now, not at a pace that he might like, but they are doing it.
Let me just take that point. Mr. Garbett's raised that a couple of times now and said there's no example of the federal government handing over land to the states. In fact, Hawaii, in their Enabling Act in 1959, the land had been taken away from the Native Hawaiians in 1893. They were very disgruntled by it as they were moving towards statehood. They mobilized politically and demanded that Congress not hold on to the land and that they dispose of it. Let me read you from Hawaii's Enabling Act. It says, "The United States grants to the state of Hawaii, effective upon its admission to the Union, United States title to all the public land, title to which is held by the United States immediately prior to its admission." Also, Michigan. Michigan, again, was created as part of the Northwest Ordinance. They got to a point where there were 13 million acres that the federal government simply didn't want to open land offices. They had the same type of homesteading type laws, and they said, you know what, we know we have to get rid of the land. We're going to grant 13 million acres directly to the state of Michigan. And they did. In the 1930s, when the states had banded together and they were compelling Congress to honor the promise to transfer the lands, the title of that bill and that legislation was granting remaining unreserved public lands to the states. And so, you know, there are clear examples of this happening before and then back in the period where the eastern states were 90% federally controlled for decades. They compelled legislation that compelled Congress to lower the price gradually and then finally grant the land to the states. And back in that period, homesteading was merely one way of extinguishing title or disposing of title. To read the property clause the way Mr. Garbett is doing it would subsume the rest of the Constitution. It would say that Congress has this unlimited power in Article 4 of the Constitution. That's very critical. Think about Article 4. That's the article creating and granting powers and rights to the states. So in the article of the Constitution creating and granting powers to the states, such as guaranteeing a republican form of government, guaranteeing that their land would not be taken to make other states, guaranteeing that the land would be disposed of, Mr. Garbett reads that as if that were a plenary power to the United States that subsumes the enclave clause in Article 1, Section 8 that says Congress can only own land if it buys it with the consent of the state legislature for forts and arsenals and dockyards and other needful buildings. Clearly, the Constitution never intended that the federal government would be a land baron and control 50% of the land in the western states, 80% of the state of Nevada. And that's a very stretch reading of both policy and law, Supreme Court cases that deal with that. But this is both a legal and a political effort. And so you've got five states now have passed legislation moving toward the logistics of disposing of the public lands. Nevada just finished a study in April, in fact, well, actually in May, that transferring the BLM land to the state of Nevada under state management would generate $1.5 billion positive net revenue, whereas the BLM loses 91 cents an acre. They looked at Utah's management of public land. We already manage 3.5 million acres of public land, and we generate $33 an acre positive net revenue, again, where the BLM loses 91 cents an acre. And so eastern states also have a stake in this situation because they're spending $8 to $10 billion a year subsidizing western states to not use their own lands and their own resources to educate their own children and to care for their own communities.
All right. Well, this is Christian Corrigan, and I think we've got two callers on the line that have been waiting, and we'll try to get to both of those questions. And we may go just a touch over our 5 o'clock Eastern stop time, but we'll go right to those now.
This is Karen Lugo from Texas Public Policy Foundation. It was interesting to note recently when there was a controversy in New Mexico regarding access for cattle to water, so grazing rights implicated, that as the federal government came in saying that they would mediate the dispute, they actually barred the local congressman from the meeting. So the claim that the BLM or federal government in its environmental role is interested in local input seems to be questioned, highly challenged by action like this when the very branch of government responsible when there is an agency overreach was barred from this meeting. So, but I did have a question for Representative Ivory. I was wondering what other states of the western states are also interested in the same kind of quest that Utah is pursuing.
Yeah, great. Thank you for the question. So Nevada has passed legislation. They have a task force on public land management that is engaging in the study. I mentioned the study that they put out. Idaho has passed legislation, Wyoming, Montana, and then Utah. You've got the five western states. Arizona just appropriated money to begin looking at the logistics of transferring the public land. And then South Carolina passed a resolution supporting the transfer of public lands, as have the National Association of Counties, American Farm Bureau, school districts, chambers, that sort of thing. So this is something that really is a substantial issue because, as you mentioned, Karen, you've got a situation now where the federal government is asserting jurisdiction that was never ceded to it. The federal government over land only has jurisdiction that is ceded to it by the state. And in its own federal report, a most comprehensive report done on jurisdiction over federal areas within the states, by their own reports, the vast majority of areas that the federal government owns, it owns as a proprietor, in a proprietorial interest only. By their own reports, they say it owns it like any other landowner. It's not the government in that area. And so these are critical issues when you see things like what's happening in New Mexico and Nevada and others, where they're not acting like any other landowner, but shutting off access, control, use, creating conditions in the forest that are catastrophic and hazardous. It's a big issue.
Before we move to the next question, do any of our other panelists want to comment? All right. Well, we've got two more questions on the line. We'll try to get to both of them, and we'll go right to it.
Well, thank you. My name is Steve Parker. I am a Stevens County Commissioner in Washington State in the northeast corner. And as a county commissioner, we've got extensive experience with public lands. So I have three points that I'd like to make rather than questions as a result of the discussion. We work together with four counties across the northern part of our state because we share one thing in common, and that is a significant forested region in national forests. But we also have a unique situation where we have a 10-year history of working closely with timber industry groups, with environmental groups, and then with recreational and other customary user groups. And the one thing that we all agree on is that our biggest obstacle are the federal land managers within the U.S. Forest Service, because none of us are satisfied with the results, and we're all pretty unified on the fact that our forest health is drastically suffering from disease and that is a result of overcrowding of the forest, and we're not able to get the kind of responses that would alleviate that and contribute to public safety, public health, and to our economy. That's the first point. The second point is that there was a suggestion made that federal agencies are competent because decisions are made by the local land offices, and I would just say that the real-world experiences suggest just the opposite, that the local agencies are hamstrung by the regional agencies. For instance, our forest is administered out of Portland, Oregon, and most of the decisions are so cumbersome by the time they travel back and forth that it takes absolutely months, if not years, to accomplish what we would consider simple tasks. That affects every user group from timber industry to cattle grazers to miners to recreationists, and I could give examples that would take too much time to do here. The last thing that does is it provides such a degree of uncertainty because regulations seem to be ever-changing that nobody has the certainty that the business model that they're using today, if they're grazers or timber industry or miners, is going to be effective next year or the year after that. And it creates chaos within the system. If we were able to have more local input and if we were able to become part of the decision-making process, I'm absolutely convinced we'd have healthier forests, we'd have stronger economies, and we'd have a higher degree of cooperation between all user groups in this part of our state, and I think that probably would translate to a lot of other regions as well. So, thank you.
You know, the commissioner brings up some great points. There was a study done out of Congress last year that the state of Washington managing forests generates 1,283 times more revenue per acre than the U.S. Forest Service because they have the certainty, they have the on-the-ground knowledge, they have environmental quality in the forest that aren't in catastrophic condition. And Washington, significantly, they have the same document of statehood as North and South Dakota, which went from more than 50% public land down to 3 and 5%, the exact same document. And yet, you know, people like Mr. Garbett and others point to this forever disclaim language and say you can't get your land because of that language. It's the exact same document as language as North and South Dakota and other states where they did dispose of the land.
This is Carl Graham, if I could make a quick comment.
Sure.
On the local management, you know, as I go to talk to these various groups and individuals, we've had BLM and Forest Service employees at some of these events and some of these meetings, and I'd like to reiterate it. They are hamstrung, and many of them are very frustrated by it. The local commissioners and decision makers, by and ranchers that I talk to, by and large, are frustrated. They like their local manager, especially in the case of the BLM, less so in the case of the Forest Service for reasons I'm not close enough to understand. But especially their BLM local manager, they like them. But that person, and they have expressed this to me personally, the BLM local managers have expressed their inability to do what's right for the local conditions, local economy, the local users, because of policies that are being pressed down on them. And that's part of that frustration that the local users and the local managers are feeling.
All right. Well, this is Christian Corgan. We've got one more question on the line, and we're right at our time, but we may go a couple minutes over. So if we can make our next question as quick as possible, and we'll get to that.
Hello. This is a two-part question for David Garbett. My name is Elaine Willman from Green Bay, Wisconsin, and I follow federal Indian policy and all federal policy very closely. Mr. Garbett, these are political questions. The first one is, What is your perception and evidence for the idea that state public lands are less available to the American public than federal public lands? That's the first question. And the second one is, to what degree are the objectives and goals of the Western states and the American Lands Council contradictory to the current practice and efforts of the present administration to reach out and overreach through the various federal agencies, lands, mineral resources, water rights, regulatory and jurisdictional efforts that are bypassing and neutering states and going directly onto private landowners at the hands of federal administrators and regulators? There is a pushback coming across the country, and I believe the American Lands Council has reason to protect their citizens. I'd like Mr. Garbett's views.
Sure, Elaine, this is David Garbett again. Let me tackle those two questions. I think I heard them. The first was, why do I think that state lands would be any less public than federal public lands? Well, I think it's two and two, putting two and two together. You know, we've heard from supporters of House Bill 148 that we need to do this to fund public schools. Well, how are they going to do that? I mean, we're talking out of both sides of our mouth. Either we're going to fund public schools or we need to turn these over because the federal government is losing so much money on these lands. Well, if the state's going to make money, it either needs to ramp up resource development or it needs to privatize and sell off the land. And likely what they would do is both. And so privatized land is not public land. I mean, I heard Mr. Graham talk about how people are worried about losing traditional rights and traditional uses of public lands. Well, if land is public right now and you can hunt on it, what makes you think you would be able to continue to hunt if that land were sold to a private individual and that became private property? You wouldn't. House Bill 148 is anathema of public retention of land. I mean, that's the whole idea here. Utah simply cannot retain the existing array of public lands and make significant amounts of money to fund its public schools. That just won't happen. And then I also explained, case in point, what does the state do when it has land? Well, we just heard about the state of Utah announcing that it was going to auction off lands currently part of a state wildlife refuge to private individuals. So I think that's what we can expect if the state takes over public lands. Now, the second question is, if I got this, how is ALEC's policy different than federal policy on public lands? And you know, I think it plays back into what I was talking about, that this is really just a disagreement over how public lands should be managed. And we've heard that frustration. We've heard people say that they want to see lands managed in a different way. And I think what the frustration is that public lands, because they belong to the entire American public, this is a national issue. The entire American public has a say in how lands are managed. And yes, people in New York might want to see their public lands managed differently than Representative Ivory in Utah. But that's okay. That's the way these things work. And we hammer these out in public policy debates.
Let me take a couple stabs at this. This is Ken Ivory. Under House Bill 148, federal public lands become state public lands. The only ones advocating for selling off and privatizing all the public lands are organizations like Mr. Garbett, out of kind of some motivation of fear tactics, I would think. I mentioned this study. I mean, actual studies done out of Nevada. Utah already manages 3.5 million acres of public land. They generate $33 an acre on public land, while the BLM loses 91 cents an acre. Washington State on public forest lands generate 1,283 times more revenue than the U.S. Forest Service, and they're not creating the catastrophic fire conditions that shut down the land and devastate it for generations, destroy watershed, wildlife, and habitat. Access presently, anyone in the commissioner that was on could attest to this, every single Forest Service and BLM plan that I'm aware of shuts off access. Thousands of roads around the West are being shut off in every forest, in every area, in every state, and so part of the issue of this is to preserve and to maintain access. Mr. Garbett brought up this issue of auctioning off land in Utah. There was a situation where there was private land that was they went bankrupt, and the state purchased 4,800 acres of land to preserve access and open space and wildlife habitat. In the deal to purchase 4,800 acres, they made a deal with the county that 1,000 acres would be sold off at a future date. And so the state either does nothing and does not get a net 3,800 acres of public land to preserve access and open space, so that they don't run the risk of Mr. Garbett trying to throw that out as a red herring, saying, look, they're going to auction off all the land. They made a deal to buy 4,800 acres, and in the deal, keeping the contract that they made, they would sell off 1,000 acres. That was the deal in order to get a net 3,800 acres for access and wildlife habitat.
This is David Garbett. I want to respond to that. So I'm glad to hear Representative Ivory say that the state of Utah will not auction any public lands if it were to acquire them from the federal government, because it doesn't say that in the legislation. And the state of Utah and the legislature have never made that commitment. I look forward to that bill being introduced in the legislature. I don't think it will be, but I'm glad we have that commitment. And then the second thing is, if the state of Utah, let me finish. In the state of Utah, he talked about the management. He calls them public lands, but they're actually school trust lands, and they're not managed for the public. They are managed only to make revenue for the schools. Now, if the state of Utah were to manage its public lands like the School Trust Lands Administration manages school trust lands here in the state, I think in many areas that would be great. For one thing, you'd see grazing fees increase by a factor of 4 or 5. The reason that the school trust lands make so much money is because the state of Utah has significant oil and gas deposits in the Uinta Basin. School trust lands outside of the Uinta Basin make little to no money for the School Trust Lands Administration. So I think what we would see is that the state of Utah simply could not make any extensive amounts of money outside of that one area, and they would be forced to do things like sell off public land if they wanted to fund the schools at a higher level than they're doing now. So, and I think he also encapsulated some of his policy differences in terms of how he would like to see these lands managed.
Christian, do we have time for a brief response?
I'll give you about 60 seconds, and then we've got to end the call. So,
thank you. In terms of grazing, under the BLM management, grazing in Utah has gone from 5.5 million AUMs, animal unit months, over the last 30 years down to 1.2 million. They're cutting off grazing. They're cutting off the production of food. And so, yes, on state lands you would pay more perhaps, but the certainty of being able to know you're going to turn out to access your water, to repair your water, ranchers and grazers and cattlemen have looked at this, and to have that certainty, they're more than happy to do that. In terms of the land under the bill, again, federal public lands become state public lands, multiple use, sustained yield, local planning right in the bill to preserve access, grazing, recreation, all of those existing interests carry over. And we certainly don't take selling the land off the table, but you do that through a very stringent process on a case-by-case basis where you've got BLM in holdings. You may have a city that's landlocked, and you look at highest and best use. But the primary focus of the bill, federal public lands become state public lands, preserving the multiple use, which is today going away both by shutting down roads, by destroying forests through catastrophic fire conditions that are killing millions of animals, destroying the habitat, watershed, air quality. Tens of millions of acres are being burned by these policies. And so there really is an environmental and economic urgency, as the Democratic governor from Montana pointed out so well in the Western Governors Association meeting last year.
And I think, again, this illustrates that this devolves into a policy disagreement over how land should be managed, and hyperbole about road closures or limited access or what is driving Representative Ivory here, rather than legitimate legal arguments that Utah might have under the Enabling Act.
You know, the interesting thing about that, where he says these lands belong to the entire public, where the Enabling Act language is the same for Louisiana or North Dakota or Missouri or Illinois. Perhaps under Mr. Garbett's reasoning, they should give back the 90% of the land that the federal government controlled for decades, or they should keep the promise to the western states.
Well, this is Christian Corrigan, and as much as I hate to cut off a very spirited debate here, we have run over our time. So on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank all four of our experts today for a great discussion. Thank you also to our audience for calling in. Sorry that we didn't get to the final two questions that were on the line, but we always welcome your feedback by email to info@fedsoc.org. A reminder that Professor Koshin's white paper on this topic is available at our website. And don't forget to join us for our next Teleform conference calls, which are also all listed on our website. And with that, we are adjourned. Thank you all very much.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.